This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, September 14, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up: in Washington, conservatives gather for the Values Voters Summit. We'll take a look at their efforts to elect politicians who oppose same-sex marriage and abortion rights. As the Occupy movement turns one, we'll look at activists' efforts to support immigrant workers in New York. And we go to Pakistan, where families in Karachi continue to search for their loved ones following one of the worst factory fires in the country's history. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Protests continued today in several Muslim countries as anger over an obscure film about the Prophet Muhammad spread. Along with protests in Egypt, Libya, and Yemen, crowds were out in Lebanon, Israel, Gaza, Tunisia, Bangladesh, Kashmir, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Sudan. Smaller gatherings have been reported in Malaysia and Indonesia. In Lebanon, protesters burned down a KFC, and one demonstrator was reportedly killed as a group tried to gain access to a government building. Several other security personnel and protesters were injured. The U.S. embassy came under attack in the Tunisian capital as well. Photos from the ground show black smoke rising from within the embassy. The AP is reporting several cars were burned within the walls of the embassy complex before security was able to push the crowds back. Local news sources say three people were killed and dozens injured. Protesters also burned an American school. In Sudan, demonstrators are being bused to the embassies of the UK, Germany, and the U.S. The Guardian cites accounts that there is an organized effort to transport protesters. One social media post even suggests that some of the buses are state-owned. Israeli police used stun grenades on a crowd of hundreds in Jerusalem as they headed for the U.S. consulate. Several arrests have been reported. Angry crowds in Gaza took to the streets today as well, and many attended a rally called by Hamas and the local Islamic Jihad group. FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
Thousands of Muslims in Gaza consider the film to be a great insult to Prophet Muhammad and holds the U.S. responsible. At a planned event, angry protesters listened to speeches by Hamas officials and other leaders in the territory. In Gaza City's legislative building, Hamas's Minister of Endowment and Religious Affairs, Ismail Ridwan, told protesters that the violence in some Arab countries is justified. He called on Muslims worldwide to boycott American goods. The territory's Islamic Jihadi group is holding the American government responsible for the film, citing previous instances of insults to Islam. Rami Almirari, FSRN, Gaza.
The Japanese government has released a plan to phase out the use of nuclear power in the country within 20 to 30 years. Before the Fukushima disaster, the island nation relied heavily on nuclear power, but after the tsunami, all the power-producing reactors in the country were shut down for safety tests. The plants have just now begun coming back online, despite stiff objections from activists. Under the plan, Reuters reports nuclear power plants will be restarted in the near future, but the government will then begin to shift its energy profile towards 30% renewable and a heavier reliance on fossil fuels. A court in Turkey today released two journalists that have been held for more than a year in pretrial detention. The Oda TV case is just one of several in which the Turkish government has been using terrorism laws to prosecute journalists. Dozens of others are still behind bars. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
It was a symbolic act of solidarity. Outside the Istanbul courtroom, professional writers and journalists dropped pencils on photos of more than 60 imprisoned journalists. Prosecutors alleged journalists from ODA TV had incriminating files on their computer, linking them to a broad anti-government conspiracy. The defense claims the files were planted by a virus. ODA TV's managing editor, Barış Türkoğlu, had been jailed for more than a year and a half. His wife, Özge Türkoğlu, says the government had targeted her husband's news organization because of its criticism of the ruling party.
All the questions that are asked in there are not related with terrorist activities. It's just basically, why did you write this news? Why did you write this way? And people are seeing this.
The court released the two journalists, but the men still face trial. And the owner of ODA TV remains behind bars pending the next hearing. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Reproductive rights advocates in Virginia suffered a major blow today as the State Board of Health reversed their stance on new rules for women's health clinics. The regulations put in place by the state's General Assembly this past spring could mean closure for 20 abortion clinics statewide. FSRN's Brad Kuttner has the story from Richmond.
After the 2012 Virginia General Assembly passed new architectural guidelines for abortion clinics, many women's health providers in Virginia were threatened with financial ruin. But in July, the state's Board of Health voted 7-4 to exempt existing clinics from the new regulations, essentially grandfathering them in. But the victory didn't last long. Virginia's conservative Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli threatened legal action, saying the Board of Health was not in compliance with Virginia state law. Legal experts, like the Virginia ACLU's Catherine Greenier, questioned the authority of Cuccinelli to override the board's vote. Greenier spoke with FSRN via cell phone from today's meeting.
The Board of Health, in its meeting today, is not bound to follow the advice of the Attorney General. It is just that, advice. The board can and should continue to vote in favor of grandfathering existing women's health centers.
With today's Board of Health vote to throw out the grandfather clause, Greenier says pro-choice advocates will have a chance to express their concerns at a future public hearing. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. The conservative faith-based Values Voters Summit kicked off on Friday at one of the capital's most posh hotels. The gathering will host speakers throughout the weekend to fire participants up for the homestretch of the 2012 elections. Republican senators, House representatives, governors, and faith leaders are addressing hundreds of attendees from around the country, telling them to work to elect politicians who oppose same-sex marriage and abortion rights and support an aggressive foreign policy agenda. FSRN's Alice Olstein attended the conference today in Washington, D.C., and files this report.
At the 2012 Values Voters Summit, participants heard talks entitled Religious Hostility in America, Repealing Obamacare, and Ending Abortion Today. One keynote speaker in Friday's lineup was House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, after calling Obamacare a threat to religious liberty and vowing to work toward its repeal. Cantor told the audience to work hard between now and November 6th to elect candidates who would restrict abortion rights on the state and federal level.
What we need is your help. Because we need a president. We need a Senate who will stand up with us in defense of life forever.
Many of the summit's participants, including California resident Paula Bagby, said they were ready to answer that call to action.
This is important. Let's register to vote. Volunteer at voting registration places, and we'd get involved with the Republican voter headquarters, and then as many opportunities that I can to share with others by speaking at different events.
A member of Pastor Rick Warren's evangelical megachurch, Bagby said the most important issues to her are defunding Planned Parenthood, preventing the recognition of same-sex marriage, and promoting abstinence-only education. She said she also supports reductions to welfare spending and other programs for the nation's poor.
Government is there to protect us as a country. We need the military. That's an important element, but we don't need a nanny state.
In the weeks leading up to the event, a coalition of human rights groups wrote to all the politicians invited to speak at the Values Voters Summit, urging them not to attend.
It is entirely inappropriate for mainstream elected officials who are responsible for advocating for the best interest of America's diverse constituents to appear at an event hosted by a group that actively works to banish LGBT people to the outskirts of society.
That's Fred Sains with the Human Rights Campaign. He said past statements made by the summit's hosts earned them designation as hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center's analysis of documents, speeches, and web posts by the Family Research Council found that they've repeatedly called pedophilia a homosexual problem, asserted that gay individuals are, quote, as a rule, more promiscuous, and said gay couples are more likely to commit violence against one another and their own children. Its leaders have also called for the criminalization of homosexuality and the expulsion of all LGBT people from the United States. The other co-sponsor of the summit, the American Family Association, has also been labeled a hate group for linking homosexuality to the Holocaust and supporting the widely criticized ex-gay therapy movement. Michael Sherrard with the religious group Faithful America said the views expressed at the summit run contrary to the teachings of Jesus.
There's nothing Christian or pro-family about the false and hateful rhetoric that the Family Research Council and the American Family Association have used to demonize our gay and lesbian neighbors and people of other faiths.
Sherrard called the Family Research Council one of the most powerful and politically active groups in the religious right. This year alone, they've spent $26,000 on lobbying for anti-gay marriage bills, increased funding for abstinence education, and restrictions on abortion rights. They've also backed so-called personhood bills at the state level, seeking to outlaw all abortions and some forms of contraception in Florida, Mississippi, and other states. Its PAC has also spent nearly $150,000 so far in 2012, supporting the re-election of Michelle Bachmann, Todd Akin, Steve King, and other Republican candidates. The Values Voters Summit will continue through the weekend, hosting Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, former presidential candidate Rick Santorum, and dozens of other speakers. Both Mitt Romney and his wife Anne were invited to speak, but their campaign announced this week that they won't attend. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
This weekend, activists are marking the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, the movement that began September 17, 2011, with a small encampment in New York's Zuccotti Park. Public frustration at income inequality and the greed and corruption of big banks and corporations resonated globally, and the movement rapidly spread across the country and around the world. The anniversary events get started tomorrow with an Occupy Wall Street convergence in New York's Washington Square Park, and the release of a Debt Resistors Operation Manual. A musical march on Sunday ends with a concert in Foley Square, featuring Tom Morello and Michelle Schacht. And on Monday, Occupy activists plan a non-violent civil disobedience at the Stock Exchange and a rally at Zuccotti Park. As Occupy marks its first year, many are assessing what's been accomplished and what to do next. Although there are few remaining Occupy encampments, the movement did inspire hundreds of campaigns and actions. Today, we're going to examine two of these campaigns, including a recent victory for immigrant workers who collaborated with Occupy members. But first, we're joined by Diego Ibanez, a member of Occupy Sunset Park, a group that's been involved in housing rights in Brooklyn. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me on, Danny.
Now, the Occupy Wall Street movement started in the middle of the global financial crisis. In Greece, there were major protests against austerity measures, and there were uprisings across the Arab world. Looking back now, what were some of the things that motivated you to join the Occupy movement?
Definitely the Arab Spring was something that everyone had on their mind. Myself, I had actually had a taste of that before. Being in high school in Bolivia when we overthrew a president, I was very young, and I was able to feel that sort of empowerment, you know, with my uncles and my grandmother, you know, and just marching in the street and really putting a face and putting our bodies, you know, with our beliefs. Ever since then, I had no idea that something like that could ever happen again in the U.S. I mean, we've always learned about it in history books, but, you know, Occupy Wall Street definitely made it very clear that what was going on wasn't just in Egypt, it wasn't just in Tunisia. This really brought it closer to us, and I thought it was really important for everyone to get a hold of.
What were those early gatherings in Sunset Park, Brooklyn like, and what were your priorities then?
Well, early on, you know, everybody from Occupy Sunset Park, most of the folks, you know, like I myself, you know, was mostly like sleeping at Zuccotti Park. That's where my house was. You know, it was in a tent in Zuccotti Park, like 24/7. Once it became clear, I think a lot of us actually didn't leave Manhattan, you know, for a while until the eviction, really. And then, you know, we got more involved with the communities that, you know, we wanted to be part of, either because we were from there or because that's a community that had helped us out. So, I mean, for a while, I was actually up in the Bronx and, you know, really appreciated and was inspired by a lot of the folks from Take Back the Bronx. And Sunset Park was really the place that I felt most, you know, attached to. I feel so comfortable and so connected to the people here. I think because you recognize the struggle, you recognize faces. I think that's really where the evolution and the redefinition of Occupy Wall Street's gonna do its best work, is within those communities.
So in your local Sunset Park Occupy movement, what are some of the concrete things that you think it's achieved over the last year?
Well, for me, I mean, I do believe that, you know, we are fighting sort of a concentration of wealth and power. That's really what we're fighting, is a concentration of wealth and power. And so I feel like the best way to fight that is through a concentration of consciousness. And so for me, the clear first step was really what Occupy Wall Street was doing a great job at. And that was not only just changing the conversation, you know, redefining certain things. You know, what does culture mean? You know, what does the word radical mean? What does it mean to be involved, to take action, rather than asking for representatives to do it for you? So Occupy Sunset Park has done a great job at definitely addressing, for example, like, a Head Start school closing down, and addressing that, and where is that connection coming from, and why that's happening, and organizing, you know, children and organizing families and helping them through those kind of things, and allowing there to be that process of radicalization and being like a building of community. And so more than anything, that is probably the most dangerous thing that's going on, is this building of community, this sort of concentration of consciousness that we like to talk about, and we really focus on that this is not just about particular things, you know, particular problems. This is built in with a bigger framework, and we're talking about addressing the systemic issues. One of the most recent things that we've actually been able to do, I think, really great job at, was there's a rent strike here in Sunset Park, and majority of the women who are taking the lead of immigrant women, you know, who've throughout history been mostly oppressed by the greed and oppression of profit over people. And so this is sort of something that Occupy Sunset Park was able to come in and say, listen, like, we're not like tenant organizers, you know, we're not a 501c3, we're not experts in anything in particular when it comes to addressing the problems at the buildings. But what we can do is provide, you know, the network and the sort of experience. You know, they asked for our help, and it was like, all right, well, when's the march coming? Like, let's set up a march. You know, we occupied the assemblyman's office, press conferences, rallies, court support. I mean, you name it. That's where, like, Occupy Sunset Park really showed the sort of empowerment that could come from people that are from that community, were able to sort of use that their own, you know, process of radicalization that they've gone throughout the years to empower other folks in their community. So it does become like neighbors being involved with their neighbor's struggle.
Diego Ibanez, member of Occupy Sunset Park, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
Another partnership between activists and immigrants recently unfolded in Manhattan. There, immigrant workers at a hot and crusty cafe have been organizing against labor abuses and wage theft with the support of Occupy Wall Street. Andalusia Knoll has more from New York City.
On a busy street corner in an affluent Midtown Manhattan neighborhood, a group of 30 people gather at a picket line outside of a hot and crusty bakery, holding signs denouncing worker abuse and passing out coffee and donuts. It's part of a worker justice cafe, where for a small donation, customers can get the food they were accustomed to purchasing at the establishment and learn about workers' rights. This picket, a collaborative effort between the workers and Occupy Wall Street, started when the Hot and Crusty Cafe's franchise owner, Mark Sampson, retaliated against workers who formed a union. Sampson responded by closing the store and firing all the workers. Morelio Ortega worked close to 7 years at Hot and Crusty. He said the cafe owner and management violated wage laws and harassed workers.
We are continuing the picket line. We proposed to do this since the owner closed the store with the goal of pressuring him to reopen the store and recontract us, and most importantly, recognize our union. We will stand guard here until we have our jobs once again.
Many of the Hot and Crusty employees worked 70-hour weeks, receiving an average hourly wage of $6 without overtime pay and no paid sick days. Workers also recounted stories of sexual harassment and verbal abuse, often about their immigration status. Mark Sampson, the former owner of Hot and Crusty, was unavailable for comment. Rosanna Rodriguez helped start the community organization Laundry Worker Center to train immigrants in organizing and labor rights. Speaking from the picket line, she said Occupy Wall Street became a training ground for leadership development for their members.
Dentro de Occupy Wall Street, hemos aprendido mucho de...
Within Occupy Wall Street, we have learned a lot from the different people involved. It has been an incredible experience. We have learned first and foremost that the workers are the most important and that each person can contribute differently with their own labor within Occupy Wall Street. Each person has the right to their opinion and there is freedom of expression.
After many days of picketing, the cafe's new owner agreed to reopen the store, rehire all the workers, and recognize the union. Rodriguez says this is a testament to the strength of their organization, working in conjunction with Occupy.
The training has been really good, and we know we are capable of continuing to the end to achieve our objectives.
When Occupy Wall Street started, many criticized the movement for being composed of mostly young, privileged white men that were dismissive of worker and immigrant rights. To address those issues, Nastaran Mohit, a longtime community activist in New York, helped form the Immigrant Worker Justice Working Group of Occupy Wall Street.
It just naturally, Occupy, even though it opened up an incredible historic space for people to discuss these issues in this country and change the discussion, I think just by nature is very exclusionary, right? For so many of us that have been working in immigrant communities with different communities across New York City, it was just within those first few weeks that Occupy started, we recognized that there was a huge deficiency in this movement and that it really didn't include the voices of these communities. And that's why the Immigrant Worker Justice Working Group was formed.
This working group is one of the few committees that started as part of Occupy Wall Street that still regularly meets and organizes. Michael Belt moved to New York City shortly before Occupy started. After being involved with various committees within the Occupy movement, he was drawn to the community-based work of the Immigrant Worker Justice Group and sees it as the next stage of Occupy.
It captured national discourse and actually changed the ways in which people conceptualized their problems. So in that moment, people identified capitalism as a problem, right, that wasn't working for everyday people. And from there, I think that we've seen that Occupy is just transitioning. It's not dead. It's not over. It's just changing, which is good. So instead of focusing on discourse, we see Occupy now focusing on coming up with solutions to problems in people's lives.
The workers are hoping to return to work in the coming weeks, but their organizing doesn't stop with this victory. They'll also be strengthening their newly created union and organizing against wage theft at other hot and crusty stores. Members of the Immigrant Worker Justice Group say they will continue to support and collaborate with the workers so that their critiques of the 1% can have a real impact on the material conditions of people's lives. Andalou Janol, FSRN, New York City.
For all the details of what's happening this weekend and Monday for the first anniversary of the Occupy movement, go to our website, fsrn.org.
Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues, our investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people, and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters.
In Pakistan, families continue to grieve following one of the worst factory fires in the country's history. An estimated 300 people were killed in the Karachi garment factory fire, which burned for 2 days. Many blame the company's owners for lack of safety equipment and emergency exits. Catherine Comp reads for our reporter in Karachi, Gabe Matthews.
Outside the Ali Enterprises factory, ambulances take away the dead bodies of workers. Many have yet to be identified. A widow and mother of one of the young workers weeps while waiting near the factory. She doesn't know if her son is alive.
I would commit suicide if my son doesn't come out alive. The company owners don't know how hard it is to look after a child alone, and they least know how to bring up a young son.
The three-story building didn't have enough emergency exits. Some were trapped in the basement without any way out at all. Others tried to escape through windows that were fortified with metal bars. Two out of the three main gates of the factory were locked. The number of deaths is the highest in the country's history due to fire. An estimated 250 to 300 people were killed. Relatives say it's been difficult to find out about their loved ones.
Nobody tells us about the missing people. The media doesn't show the pictures of the dead and injured, which could help the families to find their relatives.
Thursday was a day of mourning for the victims. Pakistan's president promised a thorough investigation, while police filed murder charges and conducted raids to search for the factory's owners. But some blame government officials, too, for failing to ensure garment industries meet basic safety standards. Another fire at a shoe factory in Lahore killed more than 20 earlier this week. That building also lacked fire exits. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Karachi, this is Catherine Comp, FSRN.
In Indian patriarchal society, many see infertility as a social curse, and women are usually held responsible for it. In response, some couples seek infertility treatment, others divorce and marry again. But a rising number of voices are speaking out against the stigma. Prabhakar Manitawari reports.
Millions of couples in India experience infertility, according to Indian Health Ministry. As the price of fertility treatments has dropped, many of these couples are hoping technology will help them conceive. Basanti Deshmukh has tried many fertility clinics across India. She says she has suffered a stigma after 7 years of marriage and no children. She says she is desperate to have a child at any cost.
In our country, especially in the Hindu religion, childless women are not respected in their families and in society. My family says that I am responsible for not bearing the child. My in-laws want to have a grandchild, and they are forcing my husband to marry another girl who could bear him a child. This is why I am trying to have the baby through artificial methods.
An infertility expert, Dr. Sudarshan Ghosda Siddhar, says her story is common.
In many parts of India, childlessness is still considered a social curse. Only females are held responsible for it. But it is not right. Male and female are equally responsible for it. Childlessness is just another disease, and it can be cured in most cases.
In Purulia district of West Bengal, a government officer, Pradeep Kundu, is initiating a movement against this social stigma. He says that the first step to get rid of these negative perceptions is to create awareness at the ground level.
We are organizing meetings in every village of the area. We are trying to make people aware that women are not only responsible for childlessness. In many cases, it is the male who has some health problem. It is curable in most cases, so women should not be harassed for not bearing the child. We need an awareness campaign at the national level to change the mindset of the people.
All said and done, it is still a long way before the mindset will change here. With more than 1.2 billion people, India also struggles to adequately provide for the growing population. While the fertility rate has dropped since the 1950s, the country remains on track to be the most populous in the world over the next few decades. Prabhakar Manitiwari, FSRN, Kolkata, India.
That's it for today's program and for the week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.